Welcome to Stir the Pots, Michael.
Thank you.
My first question is, how did you start in the pastry or baking world?
Probably back to my childhood in Brooklyn. My Nana was a wonderful baker, and we always had good bread, good rye bread, good cornbread. Corn by when I say cornbread, I mean heavy sour rye bread, and pumpernickel bread, and then somewhere along the way, I was at a junior college in Monterey Peninsula College in the early 60s. And I used to frequent, I was the editor of the literary journal there. And I frequented this little bookshop in Monterey. And the owner, this wonderful blue-eyed fellow in his 80s who would every year close the shop and take off on adventures into the Yukon and elsewhere, told me that if I came by on a Friday afternoon, I could meet Henry Miller. And Henry Miller was one of my literary heroes at the time. And I got to meet Miller. And I don't recall the name of the essay or the collection. Unfortunately, I don't have that book. I once had to sell 2,200 books for a couple of months' rent. But that's another story. In this book, he likens the decline of American civilization to to American bread, essentially to American white bread. And I remember at the end of the essay, he provided a sort of an X-rated recipe for making good bread. But then I sent him a sophomoric note because I got to thinking about bread after reading that essay. Saying how much that I realized that I wasn't eating bread any longer and how much I missed real bread. And then in the, when was this? Well, it was in the mid 60s, actually. It was the year that Martin Luther King was killed. I was a national teaching fellow at a small black college in Little Rock, Arkansas. And a dear friend of mine, Bill Boone, actually a direct descendant of Daniel Boone, and a Woodrow Wilson fellow from Berkeley, we were both teaching there. He gave me for my birthday a bread knife because I was making some breads, I think out of a book by Dolores Casella called like World of Bread, or World of Bread, something of the sort. I still have that book in a box somewhere, and maybe that sort of got me started. And then in the very early 70s, having left teaching at Skidmore College and not knowing what I was going to do, I was waitering in the village. And I was waitering at a Mexican restaurant called a Real Restaurant. And I was making this whole wheat loaf, you know, soy flour, honey. Whole wheat loaf. I mean, those were the Tassajara days. But this came from a book called Victory Through Vegetables. And as it turned out, not only did my boss love it, but the clientele loved it so much that I started baking from my little apartment on King Street. And unbeknownst to me was that Wendy, my wife of 30 years, Mrs. London, had her own subscription clientele, and she was biking bread around the village. So, and then of course we finally wound up meeting at Ananda East Bakery, which was a natural foods bakery on West 4th Street in the village. And that's when I started really baking bread, you know, seriously. Though it was, you know, sesame semolina bread, a Cornell bread that Cornell University developed, you know, for lack of nutritious bread in America. The same old story. And I remember we even made a salt-free Cornell bread that the wonderful actress Ruth Gordon would order. And that kind of reminds me of a designation. I'm never sure whether it's Elizabeth David or Adele Davis, who said that there ought to be an official designation in America called near food. You know, I always think that that's like that's still so perfect. I mean, you go into the supermarket and you know, I'm okay, there's toilet paper and there's paper towels. I mean, they are here and there, you know, getting better, but like, where's the food?
Yeah.
Michael Pollan recently wrote, in addition to his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, recently wrote a wonderful essay in the New York Times magazine, the Sunday magazine, a couple of months ago that I've made copies of and given out. I think it was called Nutritionism, or maybe subtitled, you know, like Unhappy Meals, and you know, the gist of which was to, you know, that there is something called real food. I mean, there's whole food, and so
not the store whole food.
well, I don't. Yeah, I guess Michael had some issues with whole foods.
Yeah.
Though I've done work for them and over the years.
Okay. And how did you start with Mrs. London's, or first you started with the Rock Hill Bakehouse, right?
Well, no. Huh. Mrs. London's has had two incarnations.
Okay.
We were baking at Ananda East, Wendy and I, and then West 4th Street became too small, so we took over this Italian restaurant in, not a restaurant, Italian bakery in Astoria. And Wendy and I were living in Sunnyside. And I always remember we walked through this like garbage dump to get to the, you know, to get to the bakery. But I guess we had financial problems, and the manager let a whole lot of people go. And there was, you know, Wendy and I and like, you know, 2,000, 3,000 square feet, you know, screaming at each other, working 15 hours a day, getting to the point where we could barely walk up subway steps. And we decided that finally we wanted to, you know, we wanted to move to the country, wanted to live the country life. So I think we borrowed a total of $20,000 or $25,000. And on April 1st of 1977, along with my dad, no longer winning with us, as it were, we took the bus up to Saratoga Springs. We had previously committed to a space. And on July 4th, 77, we opened Mrs. London's. And that first incarnation lasted about 8 years. And then we closed for approximately 12 years, during which time Wendy and I co-founded Rock Hill Bakehouse from our kitchen downstairs, from our farmhouse kitchen, the very house, very home in which we live. And, you know, we did that from the kitchen for, you know, another 7-8 years until it became a three-ring circus and our children begrudged its presence. And, you know, there was a period of probably 3 years during that seven-year period where Wendy, in a dressing room off of the bathroom, we had an extended windowsill, and where she cooked from a two-burner hot plate, a toaster oven, and an espresso machine. And if you came to visit, you'd either sit on the toilet or on the edge of the sink. She washed dishes in the bathroom sink and dried them in the tub. And we had a lot of bread visitors, you know, over the years. Noel Comus, Amy Sherber, Eli Zabar, a lot of people who wanted to talk bread. And I always remember one day we slaughtered our first calf, and I came, and there was a fellow waiting for me to talk bread, and I came up with a bucket, you know, with a tongue in the liver, you know, that Wendy was cleaning out in the bathroom tub. I'm not sure whether we scared him away or not. But those were the farmhouse Rock Hill Bakehouse days.
What's been your inspiration in this business? I mean, is it the hippie life that you led before? Is it going to Europe, or What exactly was it?
Well, I think initially it was, you know, realizing, you know, that there really wasn't the bread that I had in Brooklyn. I mean, even though that was, you know, just rye bread and pumpernickel and stuff like that. And then traveling to France and experiencing, you know, the bread of, you know, Poulain, largely. Though I always, I'd have to say, I think I even preferred Max, his brother's bread, Max Poulain. And I remember an article in the, if I'm not mistaken, in the Atlantic, you know, in 1972, it was in Atlantic or Harper's, and it was a profile of Lionel's father, Pierre, and there was this line in there that if you needed a lot of sleep, you couldn't make good bread, or you couldn't make bread. If you need a lot of sleep, you can't make bread. I was always a little, I always wondered about that, and then I certainly discovered what that was all about. But I think that had to do with not only physical sleep, but, you know, it took some waking up out of a sleep to realize that there was bread, and it was essential, and it was elemental. And when I tasted it, it was like going home. I mean, that there was something in me that responded to something that was very real, that just tasted like, wow, this is, you know, this is food. This is the kind of food that really sustains. This is the food that, you know, that illuminates the old adage, the old adage that you can't live by bread alone, but that indeed, if one ate bread like this, you know, that I suspect you could. And
I talked to some other bakers about American bread, and what do you think is the quintessential American bread, or is there a bread culture in America today, or was ever?
Do you mean currently, or you mean...
Well, yeah, currently and past. I mean...
Well, probably, you know, white bread.
Yeah.
I mean, a white bread, you know, the best of its kind for me is really a classic pain de mie, you know, with milk and butter. I mean, an enriched bread that way, I suspect. But I do think that, you know, you use the word, you know, culture, and that's important because as you well know, I mean, culture is another word for, you know, for a starter or a mother or a... And I think that, especially in naturally leavened bread, that there is an inner integrity, that there is a real, that there's an actual culture, you know, to that bread, and I think that emerges in real bread.
Mm-hmm. How is it that your patisserie, Mrs. London's, is like the only place between New York City and Montreal to have such fantastic croissants and product, and why is it a destination spot?
Well, it has become a kind of halfway home for, you know, pastry pilgrims, bread pilgrims, you know, I don't say on their way to Mecca, but it really has become that place between Manhattan and Montreal. I think largely because we're crazy and fanatic, and mm-hmm. we really attempt to pay attention to detail. It's very important to us that, you know, that the espresso be wonderful and the coffee be terrific and that the baguettes are consistently good. And it largely has to do with whether one has passion and conviction and the love for what one is doing. I mean, I think that's a book that influenced me early on was a book called an essay that influenced me early on was Schumacher's essay, I think, in Small is Beautiful on Right Livelihood, essentially saying, you know, that you know, I mean, what Joseph Campbell said, in other words, you know, that you need to follow your inner bliss. I mean, that if you follow your heart and your center without ulterior motive, that, you know, the right thing will somehow follow. I read, I believe in the last year, very funny story about Schumacher, by the way. He was apparently, I'm trying to remember where he was, but I guess it doesn't make a difference. He was at a luncheon, and someone served him this very white bread from which the crust had been removed. And so he proceeded to butter his white napkin. And his host came over, you know, somewhat astonished and embarrassed, and said, no, you know, I mean, I guess thinking he was a little off his rocker, saying, no, you don't butter the napkin, you butter the bread. And Schumacher remarked that, you know, if you can't tell the difference anymore, what difference does it make? Mm. And I say amen to that.
Well, I've been reading a lot about the professor Stephen Kaplan going to Paris and, you know, kind of saying, hey, guys, you know, wake up, your bread's not the best, it's not what it used to be. And I saw an article, I guess, in New York Magazine where he tasted all the baguettes in New York City and judged each one, and pretty much I think all of them failed to really come to the top of the line.
Yeah, I saw that piece as well, and I've had for many years a book of his, The Bakers of Paris and the Bread Question. It's a hefty tome.
Yeah.
But I always remember his discussion of, you know, autrefois, the bread of, you know, yesteryear. You know, and because that sort of gets into, you know, like, well, what's really authentic bread? I mean, how do we know what the bread tasted like at the turn of the century? Mm-hmm. And the whole notion of the pouliche and baking bread in that manner. So I think everyone has to sort of find what's essential for them, for themselves. I was once invited to speak at a sourdough conference in Vegas, of all places. And I forget, the great German microbiologist was there, and Professor Calvel was there as well. I got to meet him for the first time. And but I was invited to speak on the technology of sourdough bread. And I said to my host that I would only come out there if I could speak on the anti-technology of sourdough bread. And he kind of went along with it. He said, well, all right. And essentially what I said was, I mean, I think some people were disappointed because I didn't offer recipes, was that, you know, you have to pay attention to what you're doing. Everyone's starter is different, and you have to pay attention to the day and to the process itself. You know, the process itself, interestingly, is time, because we used to say in the early Rock Hill days that we use time as an ingredient. Well, it's an ingredient in the way it is, you know, a dimension, and it's through time. I mean, bread, time is process, and it's through time that bread has the capacity to reveal itself to you. Mm-hmm. And in my estimation, the world to you. I mean, through your hands, if you pay attention to what you're doing, which is why I've never really allowed, you know, radios. I'm not into the. I mean, maybe because bread making for me was a meditative process that I don't especially support that kind of dislocated schizophrenic experience of listening to the radio and baking bread. Well, you can bake a certain kind of bread there, but the baker can't really learn from the bread, you know, no focus. I remember being in the kitchen of Oriole one day, and someone dropping a dish, and Charlie turning around and saying, you know, attention, you know, and that's what it's about. It's about attention and focus.
I've talked to people about how unfocused I've sort of been when I bake bread, that I had the idea, well, it's, you know, touch, feel, and sense of, you know. And somebody said, no, it's there's science behind it, too, that you have to really capture in bread, that you have to pay attention to each development, and timing is always really important, that you can really, you can either make a really great bread, or you can make a, oh, it's going to taste okay, but it looks lousy, or you're cutting it the wrong way, or something.
Yeah. But by the same token, you really need to pay attention to what it is you're touching and what it is you're feeling. I mean, I think ultimately that is the important factor. How does the bread feel? Is the bread ready to go into the oven? Because ultimately, you know, we're sort of like attendant priests. You know, we're stewards. I mean, we kind of like make this gesture and say the bread is ready to go into the oven. Mm. But in my way of looking at things, and I'll backtrack for a moment, I remember speaking to Will Brinton, a wonderful scientist who was once referred to in the Wall Street Journal as the Julia Child of composting. Well, Will could make pretty much anything disappear without a stink. He's a remarkable scientist, and we were discussing bread one day, and he opened a wonderful window for me because he was saying, well, you know, what you're saying, Michael, is in effect happening all around us. I mean, and in the, you know, anthroposophical Rudolf Steiner way of looking at things, the formative forces, the etheric, is in that etheric exist the wild yeasts and the bacteria. And so what do? But lasso those wild yeasts from the air, capture those yeasts, put them into a culture, and feed this wonderful culture. You know, we feed it, we pay attention to it, and it makes itself. So we just sort of we give it form, and I think that in order to give it the right form, so that I think Professor Calvell, for instance, said, you know, that bread is made in accordance with the nature of things. Well, that's kind of like Yeats saying, you know, that it's the right word in its natural order. Bread makes itself, and you know, you don't have to do a whole lot, but you have to pay attention to how it feels. And if you're listening to the radio, then that's tough because, you know, you have to know whether it's cold in the room or not. I remember the week before we ever opened Mrs. Lumber's in 1977, a retired baker from Glens Falls named Charlie came to talk to me about Kaiser rolls because I used to make Kaiser rolls in the early days. And Charlie said, every night I come into the bakery, I feel like I'm a captain on the ship. You know, I've got to, like, take the temperature. Now I know there are formulas, you know, the shop temperature and the flour temperature and all that. But Charlie, like an experienced baker, he knew, you know, whether it was too humid or too warm or too cold. And, you know, he didn't have to use a thermometer. And not that that's bad, but, you know, but if you know how it feels, and then you can just sort of, like, be part of that process.
Worked with a French baker in New York once, and it was amazing. I had just come out of school, so I had no clue what he was talking about. I just was a pretender, I think. He would, like, listen to the mixer, tell the guy, hey, turn it off, it's ready, or he'd touch the dough and say, hey, it's too wet or it's too dry, and it was amazing. And Jeffrey Hamelman was telling me that same thing, that one day he was listening to the guy in the other room mixing the bread. He goes, hey, turn it off, it's ready. And I was like, wow, how can you sense that? How can you... When's the point that you know that this is what it is? And I guess, you know, it's the environment and the constant of becoming a baker and knowing your art, really. Do you think a baker is a tradesman, or is he a scientist? What do you think a baker is?
I think a baker is a baker. I mean, I don't know if you have to, you know. I mean, certainly the word artisan has been bandied about.
Yeah.
I like Paulin, you know, he always used to talk about the word, you know, money, you know, manufacture. The word money means, you know, comes from hand. Yes. And so I like that. I like that that notion. And I think one of his books was actually published by the Manu, you know, Press. But for me, artisan baking is really manual labor. That's what it's about. It's about working with one's hands. It's that that line of the poet Robert Duncan, the tale that the tale the hand tells and its way of working. That's missing in a lot of baking, even from a lot of confectionery. So many pastry chefs seem dependent on, transfer prints. I realize it's a sort of it's an easy way of doing it, but it removes it from handwork, and that's what our getting back to square one for me was all about with our fire bread. I mean, essentially baking the bread by hand and in an oven in which there was fire.
I talked to Jeffrey Him about that. That he said, there's all these young artists and guys new to the world here, and they've got all their wonderful ways, but sometimes they don't respect the old bakers, the old standard, run of the mill baking guys. Do you think there's like a loss of the tradition in baking in America, or are we rejuvenating it? Is there a renaissance really?
Well, I mean, I remember many a year ago being quoted saying, like bread is finally coming out of oblivion, it's come out of the closet or something of the sort. And I know Wendy, for instance, feels that in many ways, good pastry making has been lost. But I think the French are largely responsible for expanding the, the repertoire. I think, patisserie in the last probably 25 years has come a long way. But I haven't met a whole lot of people who really have a tremendous passion for, for pastry and for bread. I mean, I remember chartering our own pastry pilgrimage in 1979, in one of those Time Life books, the five great confectionaries or the six great confectionaries of the world we mentioned, and we didn't know anything about them, but we went off to see most of them. And some were wonderful and some were a little disappointing. I always remember my first experience at Peltier in Paris, which unfortunately closed a couple of years ago. We stood out there with, I didn't know if it was for real or not. I just had never seen, pastry so finely wrought. And it really was wonderful.
Do you think there's something lacking in the education and food today in America? I mean, a lot of kids will go to school, think I'll be the chef as soon as I get out.
Yeah, I do. And I think what it amounts to is this. You see a lot of, we meet a lot of people, interns who come out, and they've learned a lot of technique. And the real problem is that they haven't eaten food their whole life. They didn't sit at a table and eat food. I mean, isn't this what the whole slow food movement is about? Thank God for Carlo Petrini in this sense. I mean, what they don't know what an egg is. You buy a store-bought egg, the shell is fragile, the yolk is insipid, it looks leukemic, if that's a word. It has no flavor. Or even during the Rock Hill Bakehouse days downstairs, I milked the Jersey cow for almost 7 years. So our kids were, grew up on real. I mean, what's milk these days in the store? Which is essentially, you can ask the same question of white flour. It is so dead that you have to, because all the enzymes have been killed, that you have to add vitamin B by law. It's the same thing with flour. There's no germ, there's no bran. So what is it? It's once again, it's the question of mere food and something that's for real. And it's my experience that most of these kids aren't going out and eating and experiencing food. I mean, that's what we did all the time. We would spend our day, Wendy and I would spend our day off visiting other bakeries, tasting. That's all we did. I mean, I wound up early on hypoglycemic because I used to think I had a Danish deficiency. a coffee cake, you know, for dinner. But that's all we ever did was to just taste and taste and taste and then try to figure it out and try to figure out how we could do it and maybe even, if we were lucky, do it even a little better. So I think you really have to taste the food. I know our son Max has become like this wonderful cook, but it's largely due to the fact that Mama nurtured his, you know, his palate. Cool. You know, because she had a palate, you know, a painter's palate of, you know, of food and color. I mean, even to this day, I mean, Wendy won't sit down if there isn't, you know, like green and brown and yellow and, I mean, if, you know, you think she's putting together some Crayola plate, but I mean, she has this sense that, you know, that different foods have to be represented and they have to be vegetables and there has to be salad and, you know, and it's sort of like, so when you grow up eating all of this, it's, your palate is nurtured and all of a sudden when you have something that's ersatz and bogus, you can tell the difference. It doesn't satisfy.
You think there should be an apprenticeship system in America for pastry chefs or bakers or cooks?
Yeah, I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm actually a, I don't like the word product, so, but I'm actually a, I was part of the old apprenticeship program in the International Confectioners Union in New York City, Local 3, out of which now the Artisan Baking Center has grown. I've not been in touch with it, though I do get letters here and there, and but I was an official union apprentice when I first worked at Greenberg's, William Greenberg Jr. Desserts, you know, 30 years ago, and then at Claire Pastries. That's what I was. I was an official union apprentice. You know, slave wages at the time, essentially, but it made no difference to me. I mean, I would have, you know, swept the floor. That's what I wanted to do. I remember a man I worked with, John Rick, between shifts at Eclair, telling me that his mother paid the baker so that he could learn. Not that he got paid as an apprentice. Mm. She paid the baker so that he could learn to be a baker. This was, by the way, in an Austrian, you know, mountain village.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because I've talked to a lot of people about that, and they said, well, you know, America's got a different labor practice and different kind of way of paying people, and it just wouldn't fit into the kind of schedule business have here. So I always said, that's so strange. In France, they're able to do it, and there's a different mentality, I guess, that constructs that sort of system. And here, maybe it's not possible. Do you think that's true?
I think perhaps to some extent. I know that, I think that, you know, an apprenticeship is also an easy way to exploit people. Mm. I know many, especially in France, who worked for virtually nothing, and it meant nothing to the owner if they left because there was a line a mile long to get in.
We were talking about how expensive it is to open a business. What are some of the pitfalls, or what are some of the ways you can go about doing a business that can be successful? You're fairly successful, I'd say.
Well, probably perseverance. I mean, I think once again you have to have the passion and the commitment. I think about 5 years ago, my accountant said to me in no uncertain terms that I was bankrupt. Well, I reminded her a couple of years ago of what she said, and she said, well, you know, Michael, she said, one of your attributes is, you know, is perseverance, so you have to stick with it. Wendy was asked a similar question a few months ago in an interview, and she said, make sure an immediate family member is a refrigeration man. But I think largely it's, once again, passion and conviction and determination you know, the willingness to work hard, long hours because you're doing something and you're serving others and you want to make something as wonderful as possible and let the rest follow. I think if you you put the money first. I suppose it works out for many people that way, but I don't think it could ever have worked out.
I noticed you call yourself the doorman, and I noticed you doing that bit of work in your place. I think that's an important part to physically meet the guests and make them feel even more welcome.
Yeah, I love that. I've become the unofficial schmoozer. People who don't know who I am when they come in and they look at me and they do a double take and they say, "Are you really the doorman?" And I tell them that I've taken an aptitude test that I barely passed. You know that the tips aren't bad. Though of course there are none. But I just love it. I love being able to put a napkin on the table unobtrusively, and then all of a sudden seeing, oh, look, how wonderful, you know, somebody noticed. It's important to make eye contact to anticipate what, you know, the customer needs, see if someone's looking around for something, for help. I mean, sometimes the bus person can't be, you know, everywhere at the same time, and so I try to help out in that way. But it's to make people, you know, Wendy reminds me all the time that that the restaurant, you know, especially the Italian sense of restaurant, you know, the ristorante, the place where you are restored, if I'm not mistaken, it was also referred to as like the third, you know, the third place. There's the home and there's the workplace, but this is the place you want to hang out in. And if you want to hang out, you want to, I don't know if it was James Beard or somebody said, like, what's your favorite restaurant? It's the place that, you know, that really treats me, you know, that treats me well and knows when, you know, where it's always that distinction between service and hospitality. And you need to be hospitable. You want to be welcoming and warm and make people feel welcome. And you want to thank them for their business. And so we try to do it, but it's a daily struggle.
And what's your bread and butter money, the consultancy business, or is it the pastry shop?
No, I'd have to say our livelihood over the years has been, you know, the licensing of the Rock Hill bread, you know. There's been some attrition, but we still have a half dozen licensees around the country. Probably our most renowned is Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. But there's Sage in Santa Fe and Klinger's in Burlington, Vermont, Mediterra in Pittsburgh, Bread & Company in Nashville, Scholars in Bakehouse in Bloomington, Indiana.
And what's the process of becoming a licensee? What do you have to do?
I guess you have to call me. You have to phone me. and, you know, it's... I mean, what we provide is really an entire line of bread that's proven itself in pretty much all parts of the country. These days, Zingerman's provides the training. I don't know if you're familiar with Zingerman's. They're a renowned food emporium in Ann Arbor. Ari Weinzweig, one of the two principal owners, along with Paul Sagamore, Ari wrote a wonderful book on service. Mm-hmm. And they have many spin-off businesses, one of which is their bakehouse, another of which is Zing Train, which is like the Zingerman, Dean DeLuca, you know, wannabes. And yeah. Now it's not just food service people, because what people are realizing is that service, you know, cuts across all occupations, and it really isn't. You're not serving bread; you're serving people, you know, in that way. So, though in another way, I've always said that serving bread is not simply a matter of slicing bread, but, and this gets back to paying attention to bread. I know I'm jumping around here, but serving bread to me is something much, you know, much larger. And so I feel that part of my mission is to serve bread with a capital B.
Where do you see bread at the table as in terms of food? A lot of people, you know, just it's a slice of bread. It's there just to be with a food. How do you characterize bread during a meal?
I see it certainly as an appetizer. Mm-hmm. Whether it be in the form of bread and butter or bruschetta, you know, or a sandwich. It certainly has its place in the meal. Though I'd have to say that, for my own taste, I'm not as keen on bread that is too acidic. I don't really care for very, you know, very sour breads any longer. Always remember Julia Child in D.C. I was at some, I don't know, food fair, and she really enjoyed the bread, and she wanted to know why. That, you know, she said she didn't care for bread that was too sour, and that a lot of bread was. And I said to her at the time, I said, there's really a fine difference between fermentation and putrefaction, you know. And I think with a lot of so-called artisan bread, that the bread gets away from, you know, it's from the baker by not paying attention. I know the French really don't care for, you know, bread that's overly acidic. Poulain's bread was never, you know, that way. You know, it's a way of leavening bread. It doesn't have to be that sour. Though I understand, you know, there is San Francisco sourdough bread, and at one time I used to, and here and there, you know, I might hunger for a piece of it. But it's bread that I made early on. But I like a bread to be a little more neutral. I mean, unless it serves a particular function, you know, like a walnut bread that would go wonderfully with a, you know, with a goat cheese. Or I'm not so sure I, you know, answered that.
Noticed since I talked to you last that I kind of like stop retarding bread. I try to like do the bake right through the beginning from the first bulk, the second fermentation, and then bake as soon as the bread is ready, rather than sticking in my fridge like I usually do, only because time constraints. And you were saying that your sourdough, you leave it out in the sun. Can you explain the process a little bit on your sourdough?
Well, yeah, let me say this. I mean, I think that there are certainly attributes, you know, like to retarding bread, but I don't care to retard bread. I mean, it's a way of getting a crustier, but it, once again, is also a way of developing additional acidity in the bread. I think, though, more importantly, especially in so-called artisan bakeries, it's also a way of the bread getting out of hand. And what do I mean by that? I mean that you have certain people who are mixing bread, and then it sits in the refrigerator. You have other people coming in and they're scaling bread. And you have other people who are molding bread. And you have other people putting the bread in the oven. So who's paying attention to the bread? I mean, who's paying attention to the baby, you know, that's growing and then birthing in this, you know, in this oven? There's something, once again, that for me is dysfunctional about baking that way, which is why, in my estimation, Paulin and only Paulin paid attention to that process in what he called, if I'm not mistaken, retro progress or retro evolution. Because unlike all the bakeries that I know that simply get bigger ovens, and a whole lot more people, what he did was to take one brick oven and two guys working that oven and replicate the ovens, you know, in an amphitheater, you know, where a conveyor belt is bringing wood to the, you know, so here's technology. A conveyor belt is bringing wood to the ovens, but you have two people who are part of that whole process of making the bread.
Yeah.
And I have great regard and respect for that. Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about your oven that you have at Rock Hill. It's pretty amazing. I show pictures later.
Well, it's really Mrs. London's oven. I mean, it's not the oven we used in the days of Rock Hill. Though, I remember Cook's Magazine saying we made the best brick oven bread. And I remember, because I always wanted a brick oven, I remember Florence Fabricant coming up once and doing a whole review of, you know, the new revolutionary breads, and we were certainly featured in that article, but she was talking about someone else's brick oven, and I kind of felt lousy because I didn't have a brick oven, but I could say to her, well, you know, the proof's in the pudding, taste the bread. So, you know, it's still the bread. It's not the oven that makes the bread, and you have to, if you know what you're doing, you can bake that bread in a, you know, in a GE electric oven if you have to. But in my estimation, the oven we have up there on our hill befits our fire bread, and it is a unique oven. As far as I know, the only one of its kind on the North American continent, in which the entire hearth and crown are made from tuff, or tufa, or tufo, if you're in Italy, which is volcanic stone formed from naturally compressed ash over a 20,000-year period. So like the Mount St. Helens in 20,000 years, you might be able to quarry the tuff stone. And its attribute is its conductivity. The rate at which heat is transferred through tuff is much slower than through soapstone or brick. Yeah, and it's a. It was built by a master oven setter, as he calls himself, from the town of Bell in Germany. Ernst Hirft is his name, and he's now long retired. And he and his son, Ernst is fifth, and his son Bernie, sixth generation bread oven builders. There's actually a sign at the town of Bread saying this is the home of the oven builders. But most of the builders in that town were built the. I forget the word, but the tuffle oven, you know, the tile, the home ovens, you know, the heating ovens.
Stone oven.
The stone oven, yeah. And, but the Hirfts were the bread oven builders, and, you know, I, way back, because one of my inspirations in this country was Jules and Helen Raven up in Plainfield, Vermont. They had their Upland Bakery, and one of our, employees way back in the early days of Mrs. London's told me about Jules was making wonderful brick oven bread up there, and I visited Jules, and there was a cult of like Northeastern Masons, and there were a couple of workshops, I missed them, that were held at Jules' home, but Jules turned me on to this one masterful Mason, Dale Heisler, and I got to know Dale, and Dale came, and we talked ovens, and we spent a night, and we talked ovens, and then when it finally came time to design an oven, unfortunately, I couldn't afford it. So, years later, I didn't know this, but, I was in Paris at one of those bread expositions, and I met a man named Erke, who was the head oven designer for Tuula Kivi ovens, the soapstone oven builder. We wound up spending the entire day together, and he wound up showing me all these French ovens and why they were inefficient, and I felt like I had met someone who dreamed ovens the way I dreamed bread. Because in many ways, certainly the first six or seven Rock Hill breads really came to me in that way. They sort of came to me from the thought world, you know, from mm-hmm. outside. And then unbeknownst to me, my friend Dale became a technical advisor to Tuula Kivi. And then, further unbeknownst to me, both Erke and Dale pilgrimaged to Ernst in British Columbia. And Ernst was a figure that I had heard of early on, but I figured, well, British Columbia, that's a long ways away. I'm not going to make that connection. And when Dale came back, he told me of their visit. And he said, Michael, and he wiggled his little pinky, and he said, if I live to be 100, I won't know what what Ernst knows in his, you know, in his little pinky. And I said, wow. I said, this is coming from Dale. So I called Ernst. And this phone call initiated a 2-3 year phone relationship where we discussed, you know, our sort of common dream oven. And when it finally came time to build the oven, he was telling me about all this fire brick that I would have to get. And I said, but Ernst, I said, what are you talking about fire brick? You always told me about two. And he said, well, I can't lie to you. He said, you know, there's Tuf, but the Tuf is in, you know, in Germany. So he wrote to the quarry in Germany, and they faxed back a note saying, we have all the Tuf in the world, but we don't know anyone in the world who can build an oven from Tuf. So I wound up sending Ernst to the fatherland to literally supervise the quarrying of the very stone. And in fact, there is footage, some of which I've seen, but most of which I have not seen, which still after 10 years, I know who has this film, and we were just talking about it a few weeks ago, but needs to be edited, because there's not only footage of Ernst, you know, in Germany supervising the quarrying of the tooth, but of the oven being built here.
Wow.
And an interview, you know, with Ernst and Bernie and I, myself, you know, during that time. So they stayed pretty much a month with my brother-in-law, and built this wonderful oven. So there, you know, we live at Rock Hill Farm, which is a real hard scrabble farm. We have all these stone walls here because the ground here is just filled with stone, and that's how the farmers back then cleared the fields. They pull the stones out of the ground and get them to the edge, and then walls were built, and you know, those walls became fences and boundary lines. So it was really Coles to Newcastle when 5 tons of of volcanic stone arrived from Germany, and it was still wet. It was packed in these wooden crates that were filled with straw to protect the tooth, but they were still wet from the enormous cutting blade that was used to cut into this stone. And it's just a wonderful oven, though it was deliberately built as a non-production test kitchen oven for me. And, you know, it was kind of like my dream oven. So, you know, Wendy and I essentially baked more bread from our farmhouse kitchen downstairs in 4 hours than an experienced bread baker and his assistant could do at my oven in about 14 hours. but the bread is absolutely supreme, and it's just wonderful. It wears a little ash because the fire is built directly onto the hearth. The work is arduous. It's barbaric. and yet it's just wonderful. And we've resurrected the fire bread, and everyone seems to be delighted. So I know anyway.
Are you kicking yourself now that it's not a production oven, or are you happy with what it is?
No, you know, for the last year or so, because I tried to figure out a way of making this viable, and Ernst left this little square in the oven because he said, someday, Michael, you may get tired of the wood. And I reminded him of this about a year ago, and he couldn't quite remember. And I said, but it was a pattern in the brick that wasn't part of the regular pattern. He said, well, Michael, he said, if there's that pattern, then I guess that's what I did. And so we broke we broke open the brick, and sure enough, it leads into the hearth, though we didn't break all the way through. Because for a while I considered putting a propane burner in there, kind of like a flamethrower that would. And then when I realized what I was sort of moving toward, I realized that sort of defeated the whole purpose of what this oven is. So we make fire, but I have no intention. I never wanted to, when I got out of Rock Hill Bakehouse, I wholesaling bread doesn't really interest me. I mean, I really want to make handmade bread. And so what we have here is, we sell to a couple stores, a limited edition fire bread, truly a limited edition. I would like to put a hearth oven either into Mrs. London's or into the restaurant. Our next step with our son, largely so that Max can have Max, our son, can have whatever he wants, whether it's a special roll for a panbanya or a bun for a burger or whatever it is. Flatbread, focaccia, that's the kind of thing I want to do, a baked bread that has, a specific function for the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the restaurant.
Well, for me, it's more exciting than even, prospect of it is more exciting than even opening Mrs. London's because our son Max is remarkably talented, and while I'm a biased daddy, I mean that he's just he's the best of us, and he it's going to be largely a Mediterranean restaurant. Though while Max is classically trained, there are no rules for him. I mean, he loves Mexican food, he loves Asian food, but we're going to start off with finger foods. Go to small plates which could be had in larger portions. There's going to be a grilled menu, a pizza menu, pasta menu. Mm-hmm. We work with Pizzaiolo's both in Naples, Italy, and in Tuscany. We met with Antonio Pace, the president of the Neapolitan Pizza Association, essentially the pizza police. Wonderful man with a wonderful restaurant in Naples. And we were hosted by Valoriani, the oldest Italian refractory oven company in Italy. It was largely after the war that the Italian government asked them to start building ovens, because so many of the communal ovens had been destroyed. And so we worked with Pizzaiolo's around Naples, and Mr. Pace's protege in the Chianti area, who makes a thinner crusted pizza. So we learned different types of pizza, and that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Wine is a major passion of mine. We're going to have an extensive wine program, artisan, affordable wines. I like finding wines that aren't sort of in the airwave, so to speak, that are just, delicious and reflect the character of their ground. And we're going to do pre-prohibition cocktails and classic cocktails and signature cocktails. That's been a lot of fun for the last couple of years, exploring the cocktail mixology culture. So I can't wait.
And how is that going to marry with Mrs. London, since it's not exactly, it's a patisserie shop and a cafe, Mrs. London?
Well, it's going to be a real, I actually see it as the natural extension of Mrs. London's. In our earlier incarnation on the side street, we actually served three meals a day. There's going to be a physical connection between the two spaces, and certainly for Sunday brunch, the croissants and the brioche, we used to serve poached eggs and brioche with a béarnaise sauce. So that will come from the baking side. And I don't know if you noticed, but Wendy makes all of the soup now for the cafe on a domestic range, which can barely boil water. So all of the savory food will be coming from Max's kitchen, and that will allow us to even expand the luncheon repertoire. So I see a real wonderful synergy, even pairing the desserts with wine and offering wine and beer. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.